If I asked you to picture a tornado, you'd probably imagine this massive funnel ripping through a sunny Kansas wheat field in May.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that's the classic, Hollywood image.
Right, it's totally burned into our cultural memory.
Yeah.
But there's this massive newly published NOAA study that we're diving into today, and it kind of proves that the most dangerous place for a tornado isn't Kansas at all.
No, not even close.
And the most dangerous time isn't May, it's actually December. In the dark, in the deep south.
Yeah, it's really mind-blowing. The data we are looking at completely upends decades of conventional wisdom about severe weather.
It really does. So today we are doing a deep dive into the 2026 Lyon study from the Storm Prediction Center. And the sheer scale of the historical data they processed is just staggering.
Staggering is the right word. I mean, they analyzed 21,912 what they call grid hour tornado events, and this spans from 2003 all the way through 2023.
Wait, almost 22,000 events?
Yeah, exactly. Which is, more than double the sample size of any previous baseline study we've had.
That's incredible. And they didn't just count the tornadoes, right? They actually manually categorized the exact type of thunderstorm that produced every single one of those events.
Right. And that's the crucial part.
So by the end of this deep dive, you are going to understand the three distinct species of storms that produce tornadoes.
And maybe more importantly, you'll learn how to look at those terrifying headlines about, skyrocketing extreme weather and actually figure out if the atmosphere is changing or if we're just getting better at watching it.
Yeah, the better glasses theory. I love that. Okay, let's unpack this. Because to understand the geographic and seasonal shifts, we kind of have to understand the beasts that actually spawn these tornadoes first.
Yeah, exactly. So in meteorology, we classify these as convective modes, and the study groups the vast majority of tornado-producing storms into three functional
Okay,
categories.
lay them out for us.
So the first are supercells. These are the absolute heavyweights. I mean, they account for 68% of all the tornadoes in that 20-year data set.
Wow, so over two-thirds.
Right.
And structurally, I always picture a supercell like a highly trained figure skater,
Yeah.
pulling their arms in to concentrate their spin. The entire storm is just this isolated, self-sustaining engine built around one violently rotating updraft.
That is a perfect analogy. Yeah. It's isolated and highly organized. Then second, we have QLCS.
Okay, and that stands for.
Quasi-linear convective systems. You likely know them as squall lines or bow echoes.
Right, the big lines of storms.
Exactly. And they make up about 21.5% of the tornadoes. So if the supercell is your figure skater, the QLCS is more like a heavy rug being pushed rapidly across a hardwood
A
floor.
cush rug. Okay, I like that.
Yeah, because the friction along the leading edge of that cold air advancing, it causes the air above it to literally roll over itself horizontally.
Oh, okay, that makes total sense. And then what's the third category?
Finally, we have the disorganized storms, and those account for the remaining roughly 10%.
Just the chaotic leftovers.
Pretty much. They're the messy clusters that just don't fit the neat structural boundaries of the supercells or the squall lines.
Right. But my question is, how does a meteorologist actually, objectively separate a figure skater from a pushed rug when they're looking at 20-year-old radar archives? They can't just eyeball it,
Oh,
right?
no, definitely not. They rely on very strict radar parameters.
Yeah.
So for both supercells and the QLCS lines, the researchers established a baseline reflectivity threshold of 35 dBz.
Okay, wait, DBZ. If you're looking at the radar on your phone's weather app, 35 is basically the threshold where the radar energy stops bouncing off light mist and starts hitting dense, heavy water droplets or hail,
Right.
right?
Exactly. It's the physical footprint of the heavy downpour.
Okay, so that's step one, finding the footprint.
Right. Then, to be classified as a supercell, the radar has to detect what we call azimuthal shear. It needs to be at least 20 knots over a really tight horizontal distance of about 9 kilometers.
So you're basically tracking two adjacent pockets of wind scraping past each other in opposite directions.
You've got it. The friction of those winds moving in opposition creates this rolling vertical tube of air inside the storm. But it can't just be a brief swirl.
It has to last a while.
Yeah, for this study, that rotation had to persist through at least 25% of the storm's total physical depth, and it had to sustain itself for 10 to 15 minutes.
Oh, wow. So it really has to be established.
Right, an established deep rotating updraft, which we call a mesocyclone. And fun fact, over 99% of these tornadic supercells spin cyclonically, which is counterclockwise in the northern hemisphere.
Counterclockwise. Okay, so that's the hallmark of the supercell. The rotation is deep, it's persistent, and it's vertical.
Exactly.
So how does the QLCS classification differ?
It requires a totally different structure. The radar has to show a continuous, unbroken line of that 35 dBz heavy precipitation spanning at least 110 kilometers long.
Wait, 110 kilometers? That's huge.
It's a massive wall of heavy rain advancing across the state, yeah. And it needs a length-to-width ratio of at least 3-to-1.
So a long, thin line. And the tornadoes come out of that.
Right. The tornadoes spawned by a QLCS are usually created by shallower, broader rotation embedded right along the leading edge of that advancing line.
From that pushed rug friction you mentioned.
Exactly. They spin up really quickly from that friction and dissipate just as fast.
That's right.
It's very different from the persistent, deep mesocyclone of a supercell.
Okay, so the structural difference between those two types of storms perfectly dictates where they hunt. And I think this is where the Lion study really redraws the map for people.
It completely disrupts the map.
Because, you know, popular media focuses on the Great Plains, Texas, up through the Dakotas. And they do get a huge number of those isolated supercells in the spring.
They do, yeah. But when the researchers mapped out all 21,900 events, the absolute highest concentration of tornadoes wasn't in Kansas or Oklahoma.
Right. The spatial maximum is actually centered firmly in the southeast. We're talking Mississippi, Alabama, and the Tennessee Valley.
Yeah, peaking at 6 to 7 events per decade for every 40-kilometer grid cell. The southeast just has this highly volatile year-round tornado climate.
Because it gets hit by multiple types of storms in different seasons.
Precisely. Right? Supercells absolutely dominate the plains in March, April, and May, and then they shift slightly north in the summer. And the southeast gets those spring supercells, too.
But the southeast also faces this terrifying secondary peak in the late fall and winter. And that's driven almost entirely by those QLCS squall lines, isn't it?
Exactly. Those 110-kilometer squall lines thrive on the powerful cold fronts that sweep across the lower Ohio River Valley in the southeast during the colder months, you know, when the jet stream dips low across the continent.
I mean, if you live in Alabama or Mississippi, this is what makes winter nights so viscerally dangerous.
It's a completely different threat.
Right, because in Kansas, in May, you're dealing with a discrete supercell. The air is drier, so the cloud bases sit high up in the sky. It's flat. Very few trees. You can literally see the funnel coming from 10 miles away in broad daylight.
Right. We call those high-lifting condensation level, or LCL, environments. They basically give you a visual warning.
But the southeast is completely different. It's hilly. It's heavily forested with these dense pine trees. And the humidity is incredibly high, so the cloud bases are practically scraping the tree canopy.
Yeah, low LCLs. It's a mess.
So instead of seeing a massive, visible storm across a flat Kansas wheat field in May, your biggest threat is a QLCS line hitting in December. You're getting hit by a massive wall of rain in the dark, in the dead of winter.
Exactly. The tornado is completely rain-wrapped and embedded in that advancing line. It's invisible.
Invisible until it's literally taking down the trees in your backyard.
You cannot rely on your eyes in the southeast. You have to rely entirely on the radar warnings.
That is just terrifying.
It is. And just to give you the complete picture of the map, the study found that those disorganized storms we talked about earlier, they dominate west of the Rocky Mountains and along the immediate Gulf Coast, typically peaking in the summer.
So when places like California see a rare tornado, it's usually one of those messy, unorganized clusters.
Spot on.
Okay, so we have our baseline. Supercells are the concentrated spinning heavyweights. QLCS lines are the broad winter snowplows advancing across the south. And the southeast is the peak hazard zone.
Right.
But the researchers didn't just map the 20 years of data as one big chunk. They actually split the timeline in half, right?
They did. They compared 2003 through 2011 against 2012 through 2023.
And the second half of the data set contains this massive, shocking anomaly.
Well, it's huge. The relative frequency of QLCS tornadoes jumped by over 100% in the second half of the study.
100% jump.
Yeah. The raw counts showed an average 70% annual increase in QLCS tornadoes in the recent decade alone.
Okay, I have to be honest. My first instinct when I read about a 70% jump in just 10 years is to panic and blame climate change.
Naturally.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds like the atmosphere is becoming radically more unstable and just spinning up twice as many squall line tornadoes. Should we be panicking?
Well, what's fascinating here is that the data doesn't actually support that conclusion at all.
Which is totally counterintuitive.
It is, but it requires us to make a very careful distinction between a climatological change and an observational change. The study presents really compelling evidence that this spike is due to non-meteorological factors.
So the weather isn't drastically changing?
No. Our ability to measure it is.
Okay, let's get into the proof of this, because the turning point is actually the technology. Between 2012 and 2014, the National Weather Service rolled out a nationwide upgrade to their radar network.
Right, the dual polarization upgrade, or dual pole.
Dual pole. And the physics of how this new radar works basically explains the entire 70% spike.
It really does. So older radar systems send out a single horizontal pulse of energy. It bounces off an object in the sky and comes back, basically telling the computer, hey, there's a large object at this coordinate.
Right, just a blob on a screen, but it couldn't tell you what the object was.
Exactly, because a raindrop falling through the sky actually flattens out. It takes the shape of a hamburger bun.
A hamburger bun?
Yeah. Hmm. Air resistance squishes it. So a horizontal radar beam hits the wide, flat edge of that raindrop and registers a massive return signal.
Okay, so raindrops look huge horizontally. But what about a piece of a roof or a pine branch or some insulation tumbling in violent winds?
Well, that object is completely chaotic. It's tumbling.
Right.
So dual pole radar solves this ambiguity by sending a vertical pulse of energy at the exact same time as the horizontal pulse.
Ah, so it's getting horizontal and vertical data simultaneously.
Exactly. The computer compares the horizontal width of the object it hits to its vertical height. Raindrops and hail have very predictable uniform shapes.
But when the radar suddenly sees a cluster of objects that are completely random in shape, tumbling wildly, and suspended thousands of feet in the air.
And right where a rotation signature is located.
Right. Then it flags what's called a tornadic debris signature, or a TDS.
The TDS changed everything. The meteorologist is looking at a computer screen and can mathematically confirm that the objects suspended in that cloud are not water. There are literally leaves, branches, and shingles.
It proves a tornado is on the ground doing damage, even if no one can see it. Which, going back to the QLCS storms, is exactly why their numbers spiked.
Absolutely. Think about the structure of a QLCS tornado. They're usually weak, fast-moving, and totally wrapped in rain in the middle of the night.
So before dual-pole radar, a quick tornado might spin up in an Alabama forest at 2 a.m., snap a few pine trees, and just vanish.
Right. And the next morning, a surveyor looks at the snapped trees and classifies it as straight-line wind damage from the squall line. Because there was no visual proof of rotation.
Wow. But with dual pole, the radar recorded the actual debris spinning in the air in real time.
Exactly.
Yeah.
What used to be written off as straight line wind is now officially documented as a tornado.
And the study actually has this perfect, undeniable proximity gun evidence to prove that this is a technological spike, not a climate spike.
This is my favorite part of the paper. The researchers sorted all the grid cells by their physical distance from the nearest National Weather Service radar dish.
Okay.
And they found that the massive 100 to 200% spikes in QLCS tornadoes occurred almost exclusively in grid cells within 25 to 50 kilometers of a radar dome.
That is wild. So if the climate were fundamentally changing to produce more squall line tornadoes, that 70% increase would be happening everywhere evenly across the region.
Right, but it's not. It's geographically locked to the immediate radius of the radar dishes.
Why is that?
Because the Earth is curved. So a radar beam gets higher and higher off the ground the further it travels from the dish. Once you get really far away, out into rural areas, the beam is overshooting the shallow, low-level debris of a weak QLCS tornado.
Oh, it's literally shooting over the top of the storm.
Exactly. So the tornado numbers further away from the radar sites barely changed at all. The entire statistical explosion is tied to the physical reach of our new dual-pole glasses.
That proximity data is just incredible. And it's not just radar, right? The study points out other modern observation tools compounding this. Like, we have vastly superior aerial and satellite imagery now.
Oh, for sure. High-res satellites are a game changer.
Because if a tornado tracks through an unpopulated cornfield today, we can pull a satellite image a week later and literally see the scar on the vegetation. 20 years ago, if nobody drove past that specific field, it just went completely unrecorded.
Human expansion plays a massive role here, too. We call it the bullseye effect.
The bullseye effect.
Yeah. Human populations are sprawling outward into previously empty rural environments. Decades ago, a weak QLCS tornado might have touched down in an empty pasture, hurt no one, damaged nothing, and dissipated without a trace.
But today, that exact same pasture is a massive subdivision.
Right. So the tornado hits, it rips the siding off a house, tears the roof off a garage, and boom, it becomes a documented EF1 tornado.
So the weather didn't change at all. We just put more physical targets in the path of the storm.
Exactly. Which brings up a really crucial question about the true threat profile. If the overall tornado numbers are artificially inflating because we are catching thousands of small, brief tornadoes that we previously just missed, what is actually happening with the absolute worst storms?
Right, the monsters. So the study breaks the threat down by the Enhanced Fujita Scale, the EF scale, which rates tornadoes based on the severity of the damage they cause.
Correct.
And like we established, QLCS events are incredibly numerous now, but they overwhelmingly produce weak tornadoes rated EF0 or EF1.
Right, they break branches, peel shingles off roofs, maybe tip over an unanchored trailer. I mean, they are dangerous, absolutely, but survivable if you follow basic precautions and stay indoors away from windows.
But when it comes to significant tornadoes, the ones rated EF2 or higher, which can rip roofs, clean off houses, destroy well-built structures, and cause the vast majority of fatalities, supercells are responsible for nearly 85% of them.
Yes, the isolated supercell remains the primary engine for violent destruction.
So, looking at the data, did the researchers find any upward trend in those violent top-tier storms over the 2 decades?
Actually, no. The data showed a slight decrease in violent EF4 and EF5 tornadoes in the more recent 2012 to 2023 block, compared to the earlier 2003 to 2011 block.
Okay, the immediate temptation is to view that as a huge positive climate trend. Like, oh, great, the worst tornadoes are going away.
Yeah, but the authors are very clear in the data that this isn't necessarily a permanent shift.
Why not?
It is likely just a reflection of interannual variability. The atmosphere operates on these complex long-term cycles. The earlier decade just happened to contain historically catastrophic statistical outliers.
Like the 2011 super outbreak across the South?
Exactly. And unusually active years in 2004 and 2008, we simply experienced a quieter decade for the absolute top-tier outbreaks in the second half of the study. Doesn't mean they're gone forever.
Right, that makes sense. And speaking of how we measure that violence, the EF scale itself has this really fascinating quirk that the study highlights. It ties the geography, the reporting, and the damage all together, and it implies the Great Plains might actually be underrating the true power of some of their significant tornadoes.
Yeah, this is a fundamental limitation of the science right now. The EF scale is a damage scale. It is not an absolute wind speed
Okay,
scale.
break that down for us.
You only get an EF4 rating if the tornado hits something well-built enough to demonstrate EF4
Oh,
damage.
wow. So, wait. You could have a mile-wide tornado with 200 mile per hour winds grinding across a completely empty stretch of western Kansas.
And if it only hits dirt, prairie grass, and a barbed wire fence, it goes down in the historical record books as an EF0.
Just because there were no houses or buildings for the surveyors to look at and evaluate?
Exactly. No damage indicators. But take that exact same 200-mile-per-hour tornado and put it in the densely populated southeast, with towns, infrastructure, and dense forests covering the landscape.
It hits a dozen neighborhoods and gets correctly recorded as an EF4.
Precisely. So the geographic peak of tornadoes in the southeast is absolutely real. The data proves that. But the margin between the southeast and the plains might be slightly exaggerated, simply because the Great Plains offers fewer things to destroy.
That is wild. It all comes back to what we can physically observe and measure.
It really does.
Okay, we've covered a massive amount of atmospheric science here, so let's summarize the big takeaways for everyone listening. First, throw out the Hollywood stereotype. Tornadoes aren't just a spring problem in the Great Plains. The Southeast is the actual statistical maximum, and thanks to the winter jet stream, it is a year-round hazard zone.
Yes, absolutely.
Second, supercells are the figure skater heavyweights that produce 85% of significant damage, but those pushed rug QLCS lines are a massive, sneaky, incredibly frequent threat in the dark of winter.
Exactly. And third, when you read a scary headline about unprecedented spikes in storm activity, pause and ask the fundamental question of this Lyon study: is the weather actually changing, or is our technology just getting better at seeing it?
The dual-pole radar proximity gun proves how completely the tools we use shape the reality we perceive. We aren't just mapping the weather anymore, we're literally mapping the radius of our own radar dishes.
It's true. And, this leaves you with a deeply philosophical question about the future of meteorology. We talked about the bullseye effect.
Right, the suburban sprawl.
Yeah. As human populations expand endlessly into previously empty rural areas, building subdivisions and shopping centers in what used to be empty pastures, Every new neighborhood we build effectively becomes a new weather station, simply by acting as a target for damage.
Wow.
So as that sprawl continues, providing millions of new damage indicators for storms to hit. Will we ever be able to measure a truly natural baseline for extreme weather? Or will our maps of nature inevitably just become maps of us?